The only thing more unpopular than Democrats with young people is Republicans, but their issue preferences line up much, much, much more closely with the Democratic Party. And so our job is to contrast Republican and Democratic candidates for office and say, look, you don't have to be Republican or Democrat. You can be an independent. You can be a Tea Party person. You can be whatever party you want. But you can see clearly one of these candidates agrees with you and the other one doesn't. And that means that your choice is very clear.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Young people generally hold considerably more progressive views, but vote at lower rates than older Americans. In this episode, I talked to Ben Wessel and John Brocker, who are working to change this. They are executive director and managing director of the important group Next Gen America. Next Gen America is the Tom Steyer founded and funded group, which works to build political power for young people and get them to vote. Ben and John run the day-to-day of this enterprise, which has about a $45 million budget this year. Ben is an experienced operative who comes out of the climate movement, has been with Next Gen for 6.5 years. And John has worked at the intersection of advocacy, communications, and technology for years, including for many key progressive organizations and candidates. I was very curious what NextGen is up to for 2020 and excited to catch up with Ben and John. So after a quick word from our sponsor, listen to my interview with Ben Wessel and John Brocker at NextGen America.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
John and Ben, would you each mind introducing yourselves and giving me a quick biography? John, why don't you start?
First off, Nathaniel, thank you so much for inviting us on. I'm really excited to both to be on this podcast, but also to sort of talk to you again. It's been too long. And obviously these COVID socially distanced times make it even harder to connect. So to me, these are even more important. For me, just a quick bio for folks. My name is John Lee Brocker. It's a interesting name. I have a fun family history, but I'm a Korean-American adoptee who grew up on the East Coast, just in the northern part of Virginia, right around D.C. And I'm a political campaigner. I work as the managing director of Next Gen America, which is a youth outreach organization here in San Francisco, and we work in 11 different states. Ben will talk more about this, I'm sure. But I've been a progressive campaigner nearly my whole life, since I basically got started in the workforce. I have been working in towards some sort of cause, because even as a little kid, I had a sense that things could and should be better. I think we all sort of see different inequalities growing up and try to figure out in our heads, how can we make them better? And there's a million different ways in which we see inequality in the classroom, of course, right? But I remember a lot of times for me in elementary school and in high school, growing up in Northern Virginia, a lot of privilege, a lot of, you know, unexamined things going on there. But, you know, I think one dynamic that I was able to spot, even as a kid growing up, doesn't have yet a political understanding of things, or doesn't have yet any kind of understanding of sociology or history. But even as like a kid who doesn't know stuff, I still remember being flummoxed at some of the basic differences I saw to how me and my classmates would be treated, right? And I know one way to me that felt obvious was gender, right? Is that, like, I know there's a million ways we can nerd out, and Nathaniel and Ben, I hope we definitely can nerd out today, but I know for me, one way I'm a nerd is that I was in Model UN, and I know for Model United Nations, it's like a competition kind of thing. I would see who was winning those competitions and who wasn't, and how much work it would take as a woman attendee to get the respect that I could just command instantly just by walking up to the stage, right? And to me, that was one of a million little and big instances where inequality to me was just in full display and had no explanation, right? There was no other answer to me except that people were allowing this to go on and that this was not acceptable. So that sort of drove me from an early age to become a progressive organizer and to have organizing be a part of everything that I do. But that's sort of my quick, like, why I got into this. But, you know, since then, I focused mainly on the digital side of things. I've recently been working sort of more broadly. So I was the digital director for the Democratic Governors Association a million years ago. I made their MySpace page. And then I went from there to work for places like NGP Van, Nathaniel's, where I met you, as well as Salsa Labs, Wendy Davis for governor when she ran in 2014, NARA Pro-Choice America in D.C., and I was the deputy campaign manager for Martin Heinrich when he ran for re-election in 2018. And now I'm here at Next Gen America. So anyway, that was 100,000 minutes long, so I apologize, but that's sort of my circuitous journey through how I got into politics.
Well, your estimate of time is very off, but otherwise, thank you. Ben, why don't you tackle the same thing, but do it better?
Yep, for sure. So my name is Ben Wessel. I'm the executive director at Next Gen America, which, like John mentioned, works to turn out young voters to help elect progressive candidates in key battleground states. My journey is somewhat similar in the sense that as a young person, I often found myself outraged by inequities in our system, whether it was the Iraq War or racial injustice. My career has really focused on making sure young people have a voice in our political process, especially through the lens of climate change. So I used to work at 350.org and came over to NextGen in 2014 to help build the youth climate movement. But I've always been doing youth and politics stuff, whether it was on the Obama campaign in 2012 or helping to elect Ed Markey to the Senate the first time in 2013. Or helping elect Cory Booker to the Senate. I've sort of been a Democratic campaigner with my eye on the youth vote. I'm glad, John, you talked about what it was like for you as a young person, because I think for both of us and many folks on staff at NextGen, we remember how clear the stakes of everything was when we were young people. And that's why we like to give young people a louder voice in our political process, because it comes from that clarity and that moral authority that comes with youth.
That makes sense. And John, can you explain your two different roles? Who's the boss of who, and how do you work together?
Absolutely. So the good thing here is that there's clarity. Ben is the executive director and I'm the managing director. This is actually a fairly common setup, I'd say, at nonprofit organizations, at advocacy groups, places that work for progressive change. You see this kind of setup where there is the executive director who is the head of the organization, right? So is the top of the organizational chart. And then there's a managing director, like in this case, it's me, but who runs it. And again, this is going to vary widely, but sort of often it's sort of the more day-to-day operations. Ben, please chime in here, but sort of the way I would sort of demarcate it, Ben is able to focus on really kind of the wide, like, organizational big picture decisions that affect, like, NextGen writ large. So, like, hey, we have an election to win. What are kind of the major high points of our organizing? You know, there's going to be a lot of big things coming up. We have a huge holiday, National Vote by Mail Day. You may have heard of it because Next Gen America founded it. So, you know, you're welcome, America. National Vote by Mail Day is July 28th. That's going to be one of our huge organizing moments. We also have a huge organizing moment around Welcome Week. So Welcome Week is just the jargon. Different folks use different things. But around when you have colleges all across the country, you have folks moving into campus. It's, of course, going to look different under a COVID world, but we have sort of a virtual welcome week. And so that's another peak organizing moment. Ben's aware of sort of these big moments and is guiding us through them, but is focused on the organizational level, where I'm focused on things like, hey, the data flow between our field team right now and certain aspects of this database are like 95% good, but the 5% that aren't good, it's really causing some like day-to-day management issues. So like I need to get in the weeds to make sure that, like, between the vendor, the field staff, and the digital staff, we all have the right answer to, like, actually fix that, you know, broken pipe. So that's both like a big and little picture Ben, did I get anything wrong there? Please correct me if anything is off.
I mean, it's a constant conversation, right? I
think totally. One of the things also that, that, yes.
One of the things that John was too kind, he's always got to beat me back from getting in the weeds because I'm an organizer's organizer. And I'm always asking him for help on, hey, big picture stuff, I need your opinion on this because I'm not quite sure I'm doing it right. The dynamic when it works perfectly is exactly how John described. but he's being too humble about how this can really work well.
So that to me, that sounds like CEO, COO, maybe in the for-profit world. All those titles go into nonprofit nowadays too. Is that right?
I think that would be more or less accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I seem to have held on to some of the things that are neither CEO or COO responsibility, like some of our budgeting or our relationship with our key funders has stayed on my plate, and it's an adventure.
One thing that I really feel is that, although Ben, I think you're right, sort of to maybe call yourself in a little bit here, I really think to me what's been interesting is I think a lot of times we hear the stereotype of the CEO, even the nonprofit CEO, that's kind of the opposite, Ben, of what you're describing, which is kind of like the, like, hey, doesn't really know the weeds and also maybe isn't even interested in the weeds, but is kind of the, like, you know what, I read the SkyMall magazine the other day on the flight and I heard that, you know, the United Way is doing this weird thing with video. Have you ever heard of video, John? You know, and I will say, I have never had to deal with that from Ben Wessel. And so I'm curious either from Ben or from Nathaniel, and I'm not trying to take your question power away, Nathaniel, but I'm curious, like, you know, both of you having run organizations like this, I have been lucky not to deal too much with that sort of model of boss. Have you had to deal with that? I'm not trying to like call, you know, name names here, but I'm just sort of curious if you had to deal with that in the movement as much.
Are you asking Ben or are you asking me?
The both of you, I'm curious.
Well, my sense is that this varies a lot by organization size, and that in a smaller organization, your CEO is usually going to know really what's going on. And the larger the organization gets, the more likely it is that they have to sort of sit at that 50,000 foot level, although it's useful if they can come down and talk to anybody about anything. But I have one question about sort of the head of the organization, because rumor has come to me that Tom Steyer is somehow involved.
Not just a rumor.
Not just a rumor. Can you confirm like what his role is, what it has been, and how much you have to deal with him?
Tom Steyer, progressive billionaire, former presidential candidate and founder of NextGen America, which started as NextGen Climate in 2013. And, you know, Tom has really, for the bulk of the organization's history, been the day-to-day sort of CEO-style figure who was making decisions about how the organization should engage in politics, where his funding and his resources should go, which races we want to get involved in. After the 2018 cycle, Tom sort of took a little bit of a step back, focused mostly on the need to impeach campaign that he was running, and then eventually his presidential campaign. And so it was an opportunity for me to step up and sort of make sure that NextGen was just focused on the youth vote component of everything that we were doing. Obviously, we're multi-issue progressive, and we sort of, climate is at the core of some of what we do, but it's certainly not all that we do. And post Tom's campaign, we had been working closely with him just to make sure we're aligning on how to deal with organizing in the time of COVID, how we want to respond to the presidential race and where it stands now. But Tom actually just this past weekend was confirmed to be a co-chair of Joe Biden's Climate Engagement Task Force. I think that's what it's called. And so he's on the hard side now, and we're back on the independent side without our dear friend and majority funder, Tom Steyer. So it changes depending on the time of the year or the time of the election cycle. He's aligned with where we are, which is to say expanding the electorate by turning out young voters is one of the best ways that we can actually help progressives win and then get the policy change that we know we need to see.
So I assume it's helpful to have a billionaire in your corner when you're funding an organization. What's the budget for this organization these days? How many people are working there? What's the size?
Sure. I can tell you, I can very much recommend having an in-house billionaire. Tom funds about 70 to 80% of the work that we do, or at least that's historically been where he's come in. And this cycle, our investment is at least $45 million in 11 battleground states in order to turn out young voters. And that translates to, you know, a staff that's somewhere in the 250-person range. We grow and shrink, obviously, with the election calendar. And, you know, fingers crossed, we'll be able to bring on board a bunch of part-time stipended student fellows into the fall to help us make sure everyone's registered and getting out to vote. But we're a big operation, you know. We think of ourselves as like the shadow party for young voters. We know that young people don't really think of themselves as capital D Democrats, but they do hold really progressive issue stances. So we need to make sure that we are doing everything from field to digital ads to fundraising. There's no part of the campaign infrastructure that we don't want to have run out of next gen. So we're pretty big.
Well, I mean, if I were, you know, executive director for an organization with a billionaire, I would be confused about whether 45 million is a lot. Because if you got a billion, you know, your stock holdings probably bounce up and down by more than that every day. And boy, there's a huge pivotal point in our country's history coming up. Why shouldn't he spend 450 million on this? How do you have a conversation with a guy like that about, you know, what ought to be put in? It sounds tricky.
Sure, it is and it isn't. I mean, I think we have really identified experiment-informed projects and programs that we know are going to have a measurable impact on the election. And we want to focus on doing those as well as we possibly can. And that means we want to ensure we are sending voter registration forms to young people who are about to turn 18 that have postage paid return envelopes, and we'll do that with some of our partners. And we know that we'll have a turnout increase and impact from doing that work. And so it's easy to say, hey, Tom, here's all those 18-year-old birthday people in our states that we care about. We're good to move forward with this. And he'll say, yeah, I understand the impact that that has. I think always we could be expanding the work that we could be doing. I would say I'm pretty thankful and grateful for the investment that we get that covers a lot of our overhead, like my salary and John's salary and all that work, and allows us to go out and leverage Tom's initial investment with other folks so they have more skin in the game and allows us to expand our program. So like, for example, partially because we've been able to raise money from outside of just Tom, we were able to expand our program into the state of Maine this cycle, which hadn't been one of our core states before, because we knew that the taking back the U.S. Senate was so interesting to so many external funders that we were able to actually get that done. So, sure, I would always take more money, but I think we have a really solid partnership built on understanding what is measurably effective and really focusing on those core tactics.
John, how do you see NextGen fitting in to the progressive ecosystem? What's its lane exactly, and who are its best allies?
So the way that I see NextGen fitting into the progressive movement is that, man, I have so many thoughts about this. And as Ben knows, I talk to him a lot about like how we differentiate ourselves. I've been in the movement now for over a decade. And I think to me, one of the biggest problems is when you don't know what your lane is. One of the things that has made me happiest about coming to NextGen is that NextGen has one of the clearest ideas in my mind of exactly what we're doing and why we're doing it, which to me is not only sort of the youth vote component that we've already talked about, Nathaniel, which is like, look, we're trying to increase youth turnout to make sure that we win the election. Yes. I think even more sort of broadly and sort of specifically for our movement, I think we serve a really critical long-term role in making sure that for young voters, especially, we talk about different terms here, but like low propensity young voters is sort of the old way of talking about it. But folks who are, you know, 18 to 35 year olds, who aren't especially likely to vote. They're not, for whatever reason, they're not going to the polls. Folks traditionally aren't talking to them. right? So like the campaigns, having been on the campaign side myself, you know, you do the matrices of how you talk to different folks, and both, again, one, people who don't tend to vote, and then also young people tend to not be part of that matrix, right? And so the campaigns aren't doing it. Even a lot of the other organizations tend to not have the capacity, resources, or skill set to do it. Because, again, these are it's sort of a perfect storm of, I hear all kinds of excuses of like, I don't know how to talk to young folks, right? Like, these folks will never vote, right? A lot of kind of casual stereotypes that, and Ben knows this really well from years of research, but like just aren't true when you like actually like look at the data. Those folks aren't getting spoken to except by NextGen. To me, NextGen America serves a really unique role in talking to these folks who aren't getting talked to, aren't getting campaign literature, aren't getting doors knocked on. And so we are talking to them, and it is a kind of a place that really very few folks are occupying. And so we're happy to take that lane, and that's how I would describe it. Ben, would you say that's fair? That's sort of my...
Yeah, I would chime in that a lot of the infrastructure that's existed over the years to get young people involved in politics has been very touchy-feely. Your vote is your voice. Here's a celebrity PSA. Be a good citizen. Be a voter. And we're recognizing that young voters hold a pretty progressive set of ideals in this moment, and we want to be the more hard-nosed political side of that infrastructure. So we're not afraid to say we should defund the police. We're not afraid to say we need to beat Donald Trump. And the ability to be a PAC and a 501c4 means that we can talk to young people, not just about voting out of the goodness of their own hearts, but also in the interest of helping make the world a better place on the issues they care most about by electing the candidates that are going to have their backs. And so if you look at 10 years ago, the progressive movement infrastructure that was non-existent to talk to young people when I was a youth vote director for Barack Obama's campaign, that is just very different today because of folks like NextGen.
I think it is different. You're not the only player in that space. And
oh yeah, we've got lots of homies. It's great.
So, I mean, Alliance for Youth Action or Future Coalition or Vote.org or different people are playing, trying to get out the vote or with youth. What do you think of those other folks that are out there and how do you get along?
Totally. I mean, I'll take a stab then, John. I'd love to hear your thoughts too. Those are our friends, right? That's the best part of this work, is there is a network that often comes from state-based or local organizing groups that are trying to help turn out young people in elections every year and get them involved in civic life year-round. And they'll often come to us and say, hey, look, we don't just do elections. We do all this other stuff. Will you partner with us on these like hard-nosed electoral pieces? Y'all are a big super PAC and we're a bit more of a scrappy group. We are always excited about that, right? It's not our job necessarily to try and be the March for Our Lives or the Sunrise movements who are playing an activist and advocate role as well as an electoral role. We're like the election specialists. And when we're most effective, it's when we can team up with all of those crews in order to really maximize youth turnout. So I'll give you an example. In 2014, I embedded myself in an Alliance for Youth Action affiliate in Colorado, New Era Colorado, which was a team that had done a really good job connecting their legislative fights around access to the ballot to their electoral fights of replacing crappy legislators. And I came in and worked with them, and NextGen gave them a grant to do more work in key legislative targets around actually getting people to the polls, not just doing advocacy about pushing state senators and state reps. And through that conversation, I think I learned a lot more about how we can use advocacy as a motivator for elections. They learned a lot more about the hard skills that it takes in order to win elections. And together, because NextGen and New Era were both working together, we helped flip legislative chambers. So I don't think it's very adversarial. There are lots of WhatsApp threads and group texts with the executive directors and political directors of all these groups, often cheering people on and sending the funniest quotes or clips that people manage to get into the news. The cool thing about the youth movement, as far as I can tell, is it's pretty interested in building alongside one another rather than against one another.
One of the things that one of you alluded to earlier was the kind of the tricky relationship between young progressives and the Democratic Party. I don't think nowadays it's considered that cool to be a Democrat necessarily by some folks. They might want to think of themselves, say, as to the left of the party, or, you know, are disgruntled in one way or another with party labels. But when you get down to actual, as you say, hard-nosed politics, there really is only one vehicle for progressives to do politics, and that is the Democratic Party. How do you see that through the lens of NextGen?
There's a lot of different threads here. So, like, let me try to tackle sort of like one thing that's sort of on my mind, and then, you know, Ben, please chime in here as well. I think, you know, one thing I think about a lot with this question, Nathaniel, is when you look at the data and when you look at this question, right, I think it's really easy to fall into sort of tired binaries. Hey, are people Democrats or are they not, right? Are they establishment or are they, you know, revolutionary, right? I'm about to sound like the worst, like, TEDx talk person right now, but, like, there's a middle ground, or, like, there is another way. You know, when you look at young people, the research that I've seen, at least, has been very, very clear that, to me, especially you see this in the wake of the most recent uprisings, et cetera, of course young people are frustrated with, quote unquote, the establishment, but that's not just as simple as some people who work at the Democratic National Committee or even some broad label like, quote unquote, the Democratic Party. It's that young folks see, in my opinion, rather clearly how different systems have failed them, right? And often related systems, right? And sure, that can include things like the two-party system, but it also includes everything from, like, hey, if I expect to have a pretty easy-to-use website when I register to vote, but wait, oops, my Secretary of State's website hasn't been updated in 20 years and is barely usable, and I have to, you know, print out and fax my register to vote form. That's a huge, huge difference than if you actually have something that is meant to be accessible, that is meant to be used by people and by young people. So I'm not saying that you're saying this, Nathaniel, but I was just kind of the easy kind of silos or buckets of, like, oh, young people are either not engaged or they're just sort of upset at the Democratic establishment. I think it's actually sort of more that they see the seams in the system itself. Ben, does that sort of jive with how you think about it?
Yeah, I would back that up. I mean, I think the only thing more unpopular than Democrats with young people is Republicans. And so we have two parties that are not really particularly well-respected or liked. And that's why when we're out registering young people in states that have party registration, we often see about 6 in 10 young people choose to register unaffiliated. But what we do know is that their issue preferences line up much, much, much more closely with the Democratic Party. And so our job is to contrast Republican and Democratic candidates for office and say, look, you don't have to be Republican or Democrat. You can be an independent. You can be a Tea Party person. You can be whatever party you want. But you can see clearly one of these candidates agrees with you and the other one doesn't. And that means that your choice is very clear. Now, sometimes NextGen has been, I would say, gutsy enough to get involved in Democratic primaries in which it also feels like the issue contrast is really strong and where we know there are certain candidates that can help us motivate young people to actually go out and cast a ballot. So in 2018, for example, we got in early to support Andrew Gillum in his primary in the Florida governor's race because we thought having Andrew at the top of the ticket would help us motivate and mobilize young people in November in a crucial state like Florida, which, you know, maybe we rolled the dice a little incorrectly there, but that was the intention. This year, we've endorsed Rashida Tlaib in her primary because we know that Rashida speaks uniquely to young voters about the issues that matter most to them. And we think by helping push someone like her into re-election when they are an incumbent shows young people that, hey, you can actually elect champions and that they can stay in there fighting for you. And it's worth your while to try and morph and shape the Democratic Party into the sort of thing that you want it to be if it's not where you want it to be right now.
So where would you place NextGen politically then?
Wow. On the correct side. How's that? No, I say
That's better than saying on the right side.
I know. I caught myself there. We have a bunch of values that we hold near and dear to our hearts and a bunch of allies that help put us in conversation with sort of the progressive left. I mean, we started as a climate organization with the ideal of motivating people who care a lot about climate change to cast ballots so that we could force elected officials to take stronger, bolder action on the issue that I would say is one of intergenerational equity more than anything. And after the 2016 election, it was so clear that the young voters we were talking to aren't single issue voters. I don't think that young people even think about what issue do I go to the polls with in mind. They're so sort of intersectional right now, especially these Gen Zers. And so we've recognized that we need to meet the needs of our young community and advocate on behalf of the issues that they care most about. And if you look at the issues that are pulling at 80 or 90% agreement amongst young people, and probably even closer to 100% agreement amongst young Democrats, you end up with positions that are pretty damn progressive, right? So the sorts of things that sound more like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders' platform than certainly Amy Klobuchar's or John Delaney's, it's pretty clear to me that we represent the will of our voters, and we're also trying to shape our voters into the sorts of people that we think will be reliably progressive voters for the next 40, 50, 60 years that they'll be casting ballots. Does that help answer your question, John? I'm curious if you'd add anything to that.
No, I think that's spot on, right? And I think it's a balance, right? It's both that we are speaking to the values that our voters definitely have, as well as trying to be informed by the sort of the broader movement. I think it has to be both.
If NextGen is an important part of the apparatus for getting young people to vote in a progressive way and get out, what is there on the other side? Do you have a sense of what the Republicans and the conservatives have and how it matches up against what we have on our side?
I track some of these folks on Twitter, but that's kind of the extent for me some of this outreach. Sometimes.
John is an oppo guy at heart. Let's be clear.
All I want to do is store people's stuff on my computer. Right? They're like, you said something really terrible. I'm going to remember that. You know.
I'll say we see a few different groups on the right trying to organize young people to limited degrees of success. Everyone from Turning Point USA, which is basically an alt-right Charlie Kirk propaganda machine, to Young Americans for Liberty, which is sort of the Rand Paul affiliated kind of people who were trying to convince folks to vote for Gary Johnson 4 years ago. But the thing that's pretty interesting to us is that the Republican Party seems to recognize that they've lost young voters for a generation. And instead of trying to win over in a battle of ideas, they instead are trying to erect as many barriers as possible to make it hard for young people to vote. Whether that's changing the laws so what students have a trickier time to cast a ballot in New Hampshire, or closing polling places on campuses in North Carolina, or making sure that student IDs aren't eligible voter IDs in a place like Florida. We see them being bad actors all over the place. And I think it's probably been short-term successful for long-term harm. If you look at the past decade where Republican gerrymandering has split campus communities and they've passed all these sort of egregious suppression laws, I'm sure it helped them win a few races in 2014 or 2018. But when you think about the fact that most Americans make up their political beliefs between the ages of 14 and 24, they're pretty much screwed in the long run. And there's no amount of organizing that they could do, if you ask me, that could overcome the generally progressive, generally diverse-minded, justice-focused young people that exist today that are way less bigoted, racist, xenophobic, etc., than the grown-ups who make up the Republican Party.
Nevertheless, there are a certain percentage of the youth vote which will go for Trump, which prefer his personality and his politics, one must assume, to ours. Do you have a sense of why those people who are also, you know, our fellow citizens go that way?
Look, we know that Trump will probably get about a third of the youth vote to vote for him, which I will point out is the lowest of any age cohort, certainly, and pretty much any demographic cohort except for Black women and maybe Black men. It's not a big crew of people, and it's mostly male, and it's mostly white, and it's mostly young Republicans who are acting like older Republicans prematurely. But what I think is really interesting when you look at our research is there are a lot of young people who identify as Republicans, probably because their parents are Republican, they go to a conservative church, they grew up in a community where the only people they really knew are Republican, who really disagree with Donald Trump's policies, principles, and general attitude. We did a poll with our friends at Global Strategy Group this summer, and in it, we had a little word cloud, and we said, when you think of Joe Biden, what's one word that comes to mind? And when you think of Donald Trump, what's one word that comes to mind? And when you look at the word cloud for Republican young people, the word racist was still one of the biggest words that showed up next to Donald Trump. And I don't think that was meant in any sort of positive light. And so we know that there's a cohort of right-leaning, probably suburban, probably moderate, probably white people who are 18 to 35 who Trump is turning off that we can actually go out and get. It's one of the things that, to me, makes the work that we do so important. We're not just out there saying, here's how you go vote. We're actually persuading at the same time that we're mobilizing, because we know maximizing votes amongst young people is going to enable us to win in more new places like in Arizona or Georgia that the Democratic Party needs to add to our suite of states in order to win across the country.
Can you help people understand, if you have $45 million or thereabouts to spend in this area, how you're spending it, what concretely you do, and what impact you expect that to have?
Sure. John, you want to take a stab and I'll follow up?
So, Nathaniel, there's a lot of pieces here, but there's probably a bunch of different buckets when you have $45 million that you have to sort of apportion out. The large buckets that come to mind, right? So the biggest one is personnel, right? So for an organization like us, and Ben was speaking to this earlier, right? But when you think about having 11 states and when you have field staff across those states and when you want to actually do a concerted organizing effort, right? And say, hey, how is organizing going to factor into my work? That's going to change the equation pretty significantly. And so there's like a pretty significant organizing and personnel component here. That's one big bucket. The second bucket of our work is kind of broadly paid media. So if I were on a traditional campaign, right, this would be TV ads. Thankfully, this mix is changing more and more, of course. But even on a lot of campaigns, you'll see this cycle, this is still a very like TV heavy mix that's more and more getting challenged. But that's still kind of, you still see like, you know, 80, even 90% TV in a lot of campaigns. That's shifting more and more. That's not the case with NextGen. We're, I believe, over 30 at this point percent with digital spending, and digital is really where we get our bread and butter in terms of paid media. So, and by paid media, that's sort of like a broad bucket. We can sort of talk a million years about this because digital paid media is one of the biggest things in the world right now, and with good reason. The quick 10-second version of it is I'm really proud of the work that our digital communications team does on our paid media work. It's led by Tegan O'Neill. Basically, we have our own in-house ad agency, and it is wild the degree to which we have and workshop our own creative and really think through how we do our messaging is exceptional. And I don't want to go off on too big of a tangent, but it was just something that really came up while you two were talking just now is I think one of the things that I think consistently differentiates us from the talking points, USAs, et cetera, of the world is, and this is easy to say, but I truly mean into my bones, is when you look at something like talking points versus next gen, you look at something like, let's say, Twitter accounts, you look at how we talk, you look at what we talk about, you couldn't see a starker difference, right? I don't just mean ideologically, of course, right? There's a million ways that we talk about this at NextGen, and Ben, I'm sure you have a few mantras about this, but like I basically have baked into my head various different mantras of like, youth don't take BS. And also, no matter what, you have to be truthful. You can't try hard. You can't be like the principal at the school with like a very special message, you know, with a very special episode of Saved by the Bell, right? Like anytime you are like thinking you're too cool for school or like you're lecturing down, I think of course voters in general, but youth voters and especially will see you right through that. And so to me, what I see so starkly with like Talking Points USA, the GOP in general, is they try so, so hard and, you know, whatever, bless their little hearts. But like, you know, it isn't really landing. And don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say that as a mocking or a victory lap. That is not going to always be true. And the, you know, the resources they have at their disposal, we always have to be working hard. But there's a world of difference, even just how we approach our work and our organizing. So.
Yeah, I would just chime in. One of the things that's been really awesome about working at NextGen in terms of the core of our work is pre-COVID, we were doing a ton of face-to-face organizing, in particular on campuses and in dense youth of color communities, having conversations with, you know, a clipboard and a voter registration form and a pledge to vote card and really doing the grinded out version of politics that probably hasn't changed a ton in 50 years, although we had a lot more free candy, said the word fuck a lot more, and hired a lot more petting zoos to get people's attention. Now, in the post-COVID era, during COVID era, all of those hundreds of organizers and their volunteers have taken their organizing efforts online. And so some of the things that we've done include hosting the first ever political rally on Animal Crossing, the Nintendo Yes. Switch game. We have hosted Twitch drag nights where drag queens are blasting out register to vote links at the same times that they're performing. We've had raves. We've had town halls with young elected officials. We're doing all this work as a way of replicating the on-the-ground field organizing effort in online neighborhoods, whether that's a campus-based meme page or a Reddit thread that's all out to talk about Las Vegas Golden Knights. We're going to the places where young people are congregating online. And so while we are spending, you know, millions of dollars on digital ads that I think are really smart and creative, the online organizing that we're doing in this moment is one of the things that we're investing in as heavily as we can, because we know it'll see outsized dividends in November.
I just wanted to say, like, as a longtime digital organizer, it has also been unexpected, surprising, exciting to see how what to me, even just a few short years ago, was pie in the sky organizing is now the bread and butter of what we do. What used to be kind of like, oh, we would never have time for that. We could never imagine that. What used to be that is now the core of what we do. And what Ben just mentioned, kind of going into online neighborhoods, the idea that even before COVID, but certainly, of course, as we have social distancing and lockdowns and quarantine, the idea that our virtual neighborhoods, our digital spaces are just as meaningful as our in-person spaces is really being felt. But that was something we talked about for years, right? Like even before we had digital teams, right? When it was new media, when it was, you know, you had a e-communications guru, like people were talking about blogs and stuff. It was just largely laughed at, you know? And again, I think it's out of necessity, but it's been really exciting to see how we've been working on these in these new spaces and like finding some success.
I'm wondering about something that one of you said about not lecturing and youth don't take BS. That was you, John. It seems to me like there's a balance to be found when you're talking to young people about echoing back to them their theories and saying what they want to hear and kind of lining up with them versus to some degree trying to move them to where you are or you think they ought to be. Because sometimes we older people know a little more or have the leavening to be a little more pragmatic or worry about effectiveness. It's a tricky thing, right? It's like talking to your kid who's a teenager who seems to know more than you about everything, but yet there are a few things that experience has taught. How do you think about that relationship between an organization that's dealing with hard-nosed politics and the real world versus the idealism and the activism that is often in youth.
One thing that I'm really proud that we do at NextGen that I think helps us is that we hire from and of the communities we're trying to organize for every role, not just for a field organizer role. And so when I think about Alexa and Mikey, who are two people on our team whose job it is to recruit Instagram and YouTube influencers to communicate with their audiences about how to go vote, how to register, where the candidates stand on the issues. Alexa and Mikey don't have to do a bunch of research and, okay, what kind of makeup tutorials or queer fashion bloggers do we want to recruit? Those are the ways that they're consuming media because they are 20-somethings who live in battleground states who are of and from the communities that we're trying to organize. When John and I, as like the resident old people at the organization, because we're in our 30s, when we try to say some of this stuff, people give us this like dead-eyed look of like, whatever, grandpa. And so we're not trying to be something that we're not. We're actually hoping to empower folks who are coming from these communities to have the resources they need to organize in a way that they know will be effective. And so while our messaging may be poll tested and experiment informed, the mediums through which we're delivering those messages and also the exact words, that's coming straight from the heart. I would never give someone a script who is 24, who's talking to a 19-year-old that would look the same that a 65-year-old is using to communicate to a 58-year-old. It's just going to fall flat.
It's a little concerning to me that you're the grandparents, because that puts me at like great grandparent or worse. But John, do you have a thought on that?
No, like grandparent emeritus, Nathaniel. You know, I think, and Ben, this is largely similar to what you're saying. The way that I really view this is that this is about a difference in approach. To me, when you're talking about sort of weighing, like, how do we make sure that we're striking a balance between sort of teaching from experience, you know, kind of that sort of, hey, I'm maybe a little bit wiser versus like speaking to youth. I think it's about kind of hearing what their real issue is, right? It's about real listening. Because at the core, I think even the way that we frame that question, and to be clear, I come at this from a similar angle, right? Is like, hey, and when we frame it like, hey, what is it that youth don't get or what don't they know, right? It's sort of the young folks are the ones at fault here. And even just implicitly, right? And I think what's been important for me is to reframe while working at NextGen to really about thinking like, okay, why don't these folks vote? If we do talk about these folks being one of the least likely groups demographically to actually go out and vote in the polls, like what is actually keeping them from it? When you actually get down to some of the folks who are more judgy and you ask them, right, it's all the kind of stereotype stuff that I was ranting about earlier, right? It's not really informed by data. It's kind of, oh, I assume they must be lazy or, you know, a lot of these kind of really both negative but also just not true tropes. So when you actually dig into it, what we find is that the missing thing for these young voters is the connection. To Ben's point, they are as progressive as we are, if not more, right? They know that our politicians have an impact. What the connection they're missing is, okay, why is it that mailing in this ballot or why is it that going into this school on Tuesday, how does that actually change anything, right? I know the world is struggling right now. I know my paycheck is too low and my student loans are too high. But how will actually going and, you know, either punching that ballot or, you know, tapping that touchscreen, how will that actually make change? That's really the question we're seeking to answer. And so by really kind of, this sounds maybe easy, but like by remaining laser focused on that, as opposed to kind of like the teaching component, that helps us stay focused on what the message really is.
Is there a question that I haven't asked so far that I should have, that you guys would like to answer?
Oh man, I love this question, but I don't have one off the top of my head, Nathaniel.
Ben, we're looking to you then.
I think the major piece that's interesting to me is what do the next 4 months look like? Because we are in an unprecedented election cycle where we've had to throw out all of our plans so many freaking times that John's Google Drive is just full of draft upon draft upon draft. And We now, I think, are looking forward to a four-ish month sprint where we want to ensure every young person is registered at their current address, whether or not that's a campus-based address or not, that they're able to safely cast a ballot by mail, hopefully, with the postage paid. But if not, during an extended early vote where they can be socially distanced when they go vote in person. We're hoping that young people understand the difference between Joe Biden and Donald Trump on the issues that matter most to them, as well as the differences between, say, Susan Collins and Sarah Gideon or Teresa Greenfield and Joni Ernst. And we want to make sure that they actually feel empowered that voting is a part of their toolbox of change. There are so many young people in the streets right now speaking with a clarion call for everything in this country has to change right now that's built on inequity. And we are like trying to be the best supporters we can of the protest movements and the uprisings right now and connect voting as a part of the solution. And so when we think about the next 4 months, it's often how do we bring this energy to the polling place and then make sure it doesn't dissipate the day after Election Day. So if we're lucky and we do our jobs right and we elect a suite of Democrats up and down the ticket, young people are able to start holding them accountable on the first day that they join the ranks of Congress or they take over the White House. So it's a simple proposition that's really hard to execute.
I mean, if I have a fear about that next 4 months, it's the power of the dark side to use misinformation, to use concocted events, you know, whether they're investigations that are percolating along that they're going to use to smear Obama and the previous administration, the way they'll go after Biden, his cognitive abilities and his, you know, his history and all of those Senate candidates that you alluded to, and the kind of the power they have in their echo chamber and in all their media allies to sort of change reality. To what extent can you guys combat that and to give better information? And how do you do that?
I will never forget watching a focus group where a girl said, I would vote for Joe Biden if only he would support a $15 minimum wage. And we were like, oh, well, check that one off the list because he's there. And our job is to make sure that people don't think of the Democrats who are running for office as stereotypically bad politician X, but instead to introduce them to the actual human beings who are running and lay out their policy positions in contrast to the other side. I mean, the lack of information that people have about Joe Biden is not surprising. He didn't run a particularly robust primary campaign, and he certainly was not that high profile in the eyes of many of our 18-year-old voters who were 6 years old when he was elected to be the vice president. You know, we have a big job to do to counteract that misinformation just actually with real honest information. And so right now our teams are making thousands of phone calls, sending hundreds of thousands of text messages and putting our digital ads in front of millions of eyeballs in order to tell the real story about what's going on. And if we're making this investment first, if we're talking to these young people now rather than October, which is when the Democratic Party tends to do this, it doesn't allow for some of these false narratives to seep through and to be as, I would say, sticky the way they were 4 years ago. And then the other thing I'd say is that young people, like John mentioned, have incredibly good BS detectors. And the fake news problem has never been about the 24-year-olds. It's been about their grandparents who believe whatever, you know, Susie from the swim club posts on Facebook. And so our people are creating their own content that they trust and that they share with their friends that often has a better beat and is owning the Republicans in a rather crude and funny way. And like, that's what it's going to take. So sure, I'm afraid of misinformation and I'm afraid about voter suppression efforts, like lying to people about when elections are, especially our young people who have never cast a ballot before. They're susceptible to that. But we're filling the vacuum now while Trump and the Republicans and their Turning Point USA allies are flailing about trying to figure out what the heck they're trying to do for the next 120 days.
It's also worth mentioning here that I am a really cynical person. I think that like anyone who follows me on Twitter knows that. But like, I think that it's I'm worried about the election outcome the same way that I think anyone who watched the election returns in November 2016 were. I have that same worry that I think every election watcher this year has. But at the same time, one of the things we've been doing is we've been really focusing on the research angle. This has been true for many years. But for this year, one of the main areas we've been thinking about is how, in particular, COVID is affecting our election, but also just in general, the different dynamics of this particular election are going to play out with the youth vote. And so one of the things that I was really heartened to see in our most recent poll, or recent set of polls, excuse me, was the idea that at least, especially compared to 2016, this is just one of many sort of data points for us, right? But compared to 2016, I think Joe Biden is in just a much stronger position, even just with the youth vote especially, but than Hillary Clinton was. And so I think, yes, we have the same caveats we always do about, like, you know, check the state polls, make sure that you're actually looking at elections the sort of most reasonable way. Let's not take anything for granted. But also, like, this is not the same election that it was 4 years ago. And I think that's, like, worth mentioning and worth, like, you know, to me, that's good news. And I, like, rarely am willing to admit good news, as Ben knows. So.
We're definitely in a good polling point in the cycle, and I sure hope it holds. What advice would you give to a young person now, high schooler, someone going off to college or in college, say, about what they can do if they want to do more than just vote themselves? Can they be involved with you? What moves can they make?
Well, the first thing they should do is go to nextgenamerica.org/volunteer and sign up to help communicate to their peers, either in their own state or into a battleground state if they don't live in one of those key states. But I would say, one of the things that young people often forget is how powerful they are within their own communities as a messenger, right? We have for so many generations sent young, excited, mobile volunteers to go knock on doors of suburban older folks and read a script and convince them that they should vote for candidate X instead of candidate Y. And that leaves so many votes on the table when you ask young people to reach out and text everyone who's in their cell phone, or post on the group thread, or send DMs, or be a bit political on their Tinder. Like, it's gonna reach so many more voters that is the only way we have to reach them. Each young person, whether they're in high school, college age but not a student, or a 33-year-old mother of four, like, they are the nodes that connect a vast network of people who often aren't particularly political and don't have a big history of casting a ballot. So it's so sexy to talk about relational organizing now, but young people are at the middle of their own pool of non-excited voters. And we know that each young person is more persuasive as a messenger than any mail or digital ad or TV ad could ever be. And so the first thing I would ask people to do is not give away their power and instead focus on the people who they know are going to be most swayed by them.
Well, guys, I could talk to you for hours, but I don't want to presume on you more than I have already. Is there anything else that either of you want to say?
Nothing comes to mind, Nathaniel, other than thank you for the conversation.
Yeah, always good to chat. And we hope people are as excited about young voters this year as we are.
Great.
That was Ben Wessel and John Brocker at NextGen America. They're at nextgenamerica.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.